fuck are we supposed to do? We're some real pretty shit now, man.
Are you finished?
Game over, man. Game over. What the fuck are we gonna do now? What are we gonna do?
Maybe we could build a fire, sing a couple of songs, huh? Why don't we try that?
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night.
Hello, friends. It's your midweek Chapo. It's me, Will Meneker, with the usual gang. Felix.
Hello, everyone.
Matt.
Hi.
Amber.
Howdy.
How you guys doing?
I'm good. I am, I'd say, about three-fifths of the way through GTA 4, reliving a gaming experience. Here's a little game theory on GTA 4. Now, GTA 4 changed the way that we play GTA. The combat system.
Brendan, could you cut Felix's mic for the rest of the episode, please? No, we're gonna be talking about some of the political news of the week. There are some things of notes. I've lined up an excellent medley for our reading series on this episode. But before we get to the political news, I would like to take some time out of the show to discuss what I think was the most important news story of the week, or certainly the most significant to me personally. And I'm talking about, regrettably, the passing of the great Bill Paxton this week. Died at 61.
Game is truly over, man.
We're in some real pretty shit now, man. We're fucked. But no, I just that really hit me in the gut when I woke up on Sunday to see Bill Paxton had died. Honestly, one of the most iconic actors of my youth. I could not imagine, you know, even being the person I am today without some of the roles he played. Specifically, of course, Hudson in Aliens, but also the pathetic car salesman in True Lies, who has a small penis and pretends to be something he isn't.
Paxton, in that movie, he played another guy who died this past week, Alan Combs. He played Alan Combs in the movie True Lies.
But genuinely, though, he's been in so many good movies and was such a good actor. And I said it when on the day, but he just had like the perfect mix of being a goofball and a badass at the same time that I think is very hard to do. And like almost no Walton Goggins is maybe like a close to that kind of style, but like Bill Paxton, I thought was like the real originator of that.
And, yeah, he paved the way for what I do on the show.
Yeah. But I said it before, by way of mourning, I want to recommend two underseen gems from Bill Paxton, the first of which is Carl Franklin's 90s era film noir called One False Move that is excellent, and the other is the movie Frailty that Bill Paxton actually directed himself and stars in. And this was like, Frailty has a pre-McConaissance Matthew McConaughey basically playing a Rust Cole character. So that's another reason to latch onto that one. But I'd just like to extend the Chapo, prayers, condolences to the Bill Paxton family, and just know that I'm thinking of you, buddy.
To quote Ron Fournier, good morning, heaven. He was not in Good Morning Vietnam. That's just what you say when someone dies.
No, I think Matt had it exactly right. Game over, man. Game over. Yeah, that's the sad news of the week. But moving along, I guess I want to begin talking about the recent DNC chair election that happened this week. We've been talking a lot about Trump on the show recently, and you know it's hard not to. It's hard to ignore him, but there is this whole universe of the Democrats as well that are, you know, I think we've, you know, perhaps neglected. And I think now would be a good time to refocus on the Democratic Party.
Mustn't neglect the libs.
Yes. And I guess, you know, I said I'm not going to talk about his State of the Union or address to Congress last night, but maybe begin by talking about the Democratic response to that last night, because that was surreal.
Look, when somebody says that they're going to publish all immigrant crimes, and, you know, has this heart-tugging moment where they have the widow of a guy that they got killed in the dumbest way possible. The best thing you can do is trot out a bone-dry dying man to talk about Medicare expansion that he did 4, 5, 6 years ago.
To be clear, though, this guy is not the Bashir or whatever, is not actually in government, right? He's the former governor of Kentucky.
He's the ex-governor of Kentucky, and he did do one of the most successful Obamacare rollouts in the country. His KY Connect system, the state exchanges he created, was one of the better ones. But he left office after term limits last year, and he was replaced by a Republican who promptly destroyed the exchange at the cost of millions of dollars and has promised to basically kill poor people. So once again, hell of a job keeping maintaining all of those awesome incremental gains that you keep making, and then them not at all just being immediately erased because you don't know how to fucking sell anything.
Well, I thought just visually it was very surreal because he looks to be about 90 years old and was sitting in a diner filled with other old people. And it was just, it reminded me of that scene late in The Sopranos where Artie and his wife, like the restaurant is losing money and they have to put coupons in the newspaper for like the early bird special. And like they open the door at the end of the episode and just this like sea of retirees just flood into the restaurant for like half off pasta. That's what it reminded me of. It was a very sort of John Kasich scene as
well. Yeah, yeah, yeah. These are the people that John Kasich asks for phone chargers and spare crumbs from.
And it's such a perfect example of what these fuckers take from things. So they lose the election to Trump, total shocker, and that makes them start thinking, oh my God, what should we do? How do we deal with reaching out to these people who have spurned us? And does it have anything to do with, you know, actually proposing policies or anything? No, no, no. Just get the cast of Cocoon out there. Be like, hey, old white people. We have old white people, too.
Yeah.
Basics,
so,
panicked, surface-level bullshit.
Joanne Reed posted something like, to all the liberal keyboard warriors snarking out there, which I'm all those things. she said, keep in mind that this response is not game towards Democrats. It's game towards undecideds. And, if this election showed anything, undecideds love actively dying Democrats who present barely any alternative vision and just suck up all the air around them. That's what people were clamoring for. The biggest complaint about Hillary was that she was not dying enough.
Well, I mean, like, to your point, Felix, like, this is the refrain you hear a lot. Like, you know, it looks bad to people like us because, you know, we're a pack of, you know, ironic jackals living in elite circles. But like, no, you don't understand what this is like to the rest of the people.
If anyone understands, it's Joanne Reed, by the way.
But, you know, like to this point, like, okay, well, if this message isn't to us, right, and it isn't to like any of the millions of young people who are like angry and energized right now, who the fuck is it for? And this goes into, you know, what I want to bring up now, the other thing that happened this past week, the DNC chair election, right? Close race, but Tom Perez, who was very clearly the establishment stalking horse, pulled out this, you know, squeaker win against Keith Ellison, who clearly represented more of the younger Bernie wing of the party. And now I remember in our episode right after the election, our We Live in the Zone Now episode, I made mention of the possibility of Keith Ellison being the DNC chair. And I think I said, I'm sure he's all right, but I'm not going to try to get too emotionally invested in anything the Democratic Party does because, like, this is like polishing the brass in the Titanic at this point. That being said, seeing this all go down, it sort of felt like, you know, I told myself I wasn't going to get angry or watch the Super Bowl. And then I did. And of course, was really fucking angry at how it turned out.
I was not surprised. I was not upset because it's not a, you know, meaningful position, to be honest. It's not like he would be setting the platform for the Democratic Party. So I was neither surprised nor upset. But when I thought about it, I realized they're not even giving us totally symbolic gestures anymore. mm-hmm. which is super strange because this would have been for a well-oiled Democratic Party. This would have been like a perfect opportunity for them to just pull some bullshit out and be like, ah, we gave you a Bernie guy
yeah.
for a DNC chair. And meanwhile, you know, people like me would be screaming, it doesn't mean anything. He doesn't really have right. any power.
Right. You know, I never thought like, at no point was I like, oh, the Democratic Party is going to go in this good direction if Ellison gets in there. My rage is really at the total contempt they have for anything resembling the left. This
yeah.
young wave, this like
because
this young wave behind
Ellison.
Because
it would have been conceding
nothing. Yeah,
it would have been
nothing.
A total gesture.
It would still, Chuck Schumer would still be fucking running things. But
absolutely.
They can't even do that. They can't even fucking do that.
Yeah.
They told their fucking people to applaud for every fucking thing that Trump said, but they can't even give the left wing of the party fucking shit. That fucking ghoul Perez gets up there and says, I'm going to make Ellison the fake vice chair because I want him to be the face of the party. Well, you just completely got in the way of him being the fucking face of the party.
You could have had a good face. They don't even want a good face
yeah.
anymore.
They want a guy. They want a guy who looks like an apple that I left on my fucking radiator for 2 weeks.
Well, they can't give it up. Even symbolic gestures are too much because it opens the door, and they got to keep the door fucking slammed shut. And they need to, it's all about exerting power and showing them who's boss.
But that's insane.
You have no opportunities here.
That's like, insane, though. If they want to, like, maintain power, they should be throwing us a bone right now and lying
no,
to us the way the Democratic Party has in the past and been like, well,
no,
look, we'll give you this, it'll be great.
They believe wholeheartedly, especially with Trump as president, no, you got nowhere else to go. So you could have your little tantrums, but at the end of the day, we're the only game in town. You're going to come back to us. They're 100% confident of that, and so they have nothing but contempt. They're not scared at all.
They yeah. are. They're just like fucking like horrible, shitty, alcoholic, deadbeat dad saying, she'll come back. She's not coming back.
And they can't even face it and tell us what this actually is. It's so obvious to anyone who has any clear vision of this. Just a fucking act of spite towards anything resembling the left.
Yeah.
But when you challenge them on it, they go, well, Perez and Ellison are the same. Well, why the fuck did he run then?
Why, not,
okay. why the
yeah.
fuck is
Ellison.
He in there?
Felix, that is exactly the point that I saw being made over and over again, where it's just like, well, all these people that are upset about Ellison... Him and Ellison are exactly the same. And then I actually tried to engage a couple people, and I said, if they're exactly the same, why did Perez run? And the answer I got over and over again was, he's an ambitious guy. Maybe he thought he'd do a better job, which is totally fucking wrong.
Yeah,
and
he's
to this point, actually, I want to read from a Medium post that Matt Brunig wrote this week summarizing this, and I thought it was very concise and clear and said it exactly what needed to be said. But the essential point is that Tom Perez was solicited. This is covered in news articles. He was specifically recruited and solicited by Obama's people to run against Keith Ellison. He didn't just decide for himself that my vision, you know, hey, I can get things done better than Ellison, or, you know, I'm ambitious, I want to do this. So let me just read here from what Brunig writes. He says, let's be very clear about what happened here. It was the establishment wing that decided to recruit and then stand up a candidate in order to fight an internal battle against the left faction of the party. It was the establishment wing that then dumped massive piles of opposition research on one of their own party members. He's, of course, referring to all of the bullshit that came out about how Keith Ellison was an anti-Semite, intimations about his Muslim faith, you know, like Nation of Islam bullshit, continuing here, it says, and it was the establishment wing that did all of this in the shadow of Trump, sowing disunity in order to contest a position whose leadership they insist does not really matter. And like, this is it. Like, they will use this now to be like, again, a call for unity to come together. You know, let's rally around Perez. We need to have a unified party. And just to close out, I think he gets exactly right what this means for people who are on the left or consider the Democratic Party inadequate. Just to finish, he says, the left should focus its energies on organizing under alternative institutions that, if they engage the Democratic Party at all, only do so in order to attempt hostile takeovers of various power positions, including primarying moderate Democrats and winning local party positions. Only a sucker would do more than that, given what the party has just shown itself to be about at this time. You think that's fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another element to this that infuriated me more than anything. And it goes back to the thing where people would say, well, they're the same. They have the same views. And yes, of course, the first question is, well, why the hell did Perez run in the first place? But the second is that even saying that shows that these people are either lying or genuinely don't understand how politics works. And I think it's probably 50-50. And that is, it does not matter what an individual political figure's personal political views on any subject are. What matters is, who is he beholden to his power for? What what coalition of interests does he owe his position? And when it's Perez versus Ellison, Perez was beholden to the Obama and Clinton people and the big donors, and Ellison would have been beholden to the grassroots. That's the fucking difference. Their personal views on any specific issue are absolutely meaningless. And to not understand that basic fact about politics, no wonder you get your fucking asses kicked every goddamn day, because you don't realize what's happening, because you genuinely do think this is some West Wing shit, where it comes down to your truly held beliefs and your ability to convince people of it.
Matt, that's exactly right. And like, I feel like I see this all the time, this very superficial understanding of politics, where you just sort of like rank the public statements of figures based on like whether you like it or not, or whether it sounds good to you, and just like, you know, line them up together along with their, you know, identity or whatever, and then just score it that way. And it's just this very surface level understanding. And that's why I think it's basically impossible to argue with these people, because we're dealing from a different deck entirely.
Well, they're building a golem of cynicism, and they expect it to work for them and to never bite them in the ass. They expect the people that they're, you know, telling to lower their standards are never going to resent them for doing that.
Yeah.
It's insane.
They're like an incompetent colonial authority. It's like being run by a French colonial officer. That's the opposition party. Obama has just secured $60 million to write about his book. And
cannot
do you think
wait.
This guy gives a fuck? Do you think he gives a fucking shit about what happens?
No.
He doesn't. He's just another fucking rich guy who went to an Ivy League school now. But you are going to let him dictate who runs the party. You know, who even knows what his motivations are? Maybe it's this egotistical thing that he wants the Democratic Party to still be the Obama Democrats. The people who, even if they have these beliefs like Tom Perez allegedly does, the ambitious Tom Perez who didn't run for a party leadership position until he was 900 fucking years old, who they may have these beliefs, but the way that they execute those beliefs is by showing up to negotiation with that in the back of their head, but already beginning at the position of compromise. Another reason why their personal beliefs don't matter, because they worship process and compromise so much that ideal that they had, it's already out the window when they're walking down the hallway to meet with fucking McConnell or whatever fucking ghoul.
And to your point about compromise, I think this speaks to Ellison himself. He is a compromise candidate, okay?
Like
Bernie Sanders. Like, he's not great, but there are signs that he is not completely terrible. And, like, this is the thing. Like, I think Amber's right. I don't think it really matters who's in charge of the DNC, but I think, like, this is of note, at least, because what it is it's an augur of the future. And again, we are, you know...
They've taken on a policy of contempt.
The question
That's
is asked.
That's how they're dealing with the internal dissent. That's how they're dealing with the loss of their base.
The energy is out there, and like, there are signs to be like, can we have something that's not completely awful to represent it? And the answer, so thus far, every time has been no, eat shit. So that's why I think the Ellison Perez thing matters to the extent that it does at all.
I think it, in some ways, this actually does augur well, and this isn't just me saying it after the fact because Ellison lost. The day before, I thought, well, what actually is the end game here? And I thought about Ellison being in there, and I thought about all this. There's this incredible left energy now, but if Ellison got in there, there would have been thousands of activists whose goal is now to reform this fucking awful monster that's run by non-elected officials who resent people even contacting them, that's funded entirely by fucking financial services lobbyists and Lockheed Martin, that they could reform this thing into being not being what it is. I think it augurs better that this energy will not be tied down into the Democratic Party. But it's still incredibly frustrating to even to deal with these people's smugness, their know-it-all attitude. As Matt said, you cannot act like you have the practical solution to everything, that you worship practicality, if you fucking not just lost to Grimace for president, but you lost 1,000-plus state legislature seats. You lost 13 governorships. You lost the House and the fucking Senate. You lost everything that isn't the fucking Westchester School Board, and you're even going to fucking lose that when you finally run Chelsea Clinton and she loses to one of Donald Trump's illegitimate sons.
Well, I mean, yeah, and this is when I tried to engage some of these people. I just think, like, for a lot of people who are still, you know, like, I don't know, Democratic Party stalwarts or liberals, I don't know why, but I don't think they've fully come to terms with just how completely the Democratic Party has failed as a party and them.
Hillary won by 3 million votes. They don't have to do anything.
Right. I mean, that's their line, right? That Hillary actually did win the election, so they didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, Hillary won because nobody knew about the Electoral College until the day after the election.
Any sort of like, they can't even symbolically get rid of some failed apparatchik like Tom Perez, who has the stink of failure all over him. And it's just like, with the Democratic Party, we know it would be a positive sign. The next Democratic Party conference should take a page from the Bath Party conference in 1979. Now, that sucks, obviously, but I do want to make note of something else that I read this week that I think is worth discussing on the show, that I think is a good sign and cause for optimism. We've been talking about how the Democratic Party has pretty much, abandoned its grassroots and has nothing but contempt for anyone left of the neoliberal consensus. That is not the view, by the way, from CPAC. And I want to talk about this article that came out this week in Vox by Jeff Stein titled, "How Conservatives Want to Break Bernie Sanders' Spell Over Young Americans." And I think this is interesting because he went there to cover CPAC. And the view from CPAC is that, like, sure, they were gloating over beating Hillary Clinton, but the person that they were most focused on was Bernie Sanders. And I think it's clear, at least to the right, who they regard as a threat. And it certainly isn't fucking Tom Perez
or the Obama Clinton. They still don't get it, either, that it's not Bernie. They still don't get. They still say how to break his spell over young, like he's the fucking Pied Piper.
Come on, you can't deny the raw sexual charisma of that 79-year-old Jewish man.
Yeah, he's not that charming. I mean, that's half of his appeal is that he's not charming. He just has good ideas, and people just want something a little bit better for themselves.
The mutants at CPAC are like, God, we could just. We'd get all these young people stop liking Sanders if he wasn't so hot.
Yeah, that must be where they're at. They're like, what is this newfangled thing the kids are into?
So I just want to, there were some great quotes in this Vox piece. And like I said, I read it and it made me feel optimistic about the future. It really did. I was going to begin here. Mercedes Schlapp was delivering a warning about the dangers of young Americans' support for socialism. Again, I just love the Dickensian character to these names. It just says Mercedes Schlapp. It's like an onomatopoeia.
Hi, I'm the head of the Pinochet Center for Economic Freedom. My name is Portia Plopp.
He said, she was delivering a warning about the dangers of young Americans' support for socialism when she turned to face thousands of conservatives in the crowd. Parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, this is your responsibility, Schlapp, a columnist at the New York Times. Sorry, at the Washington Times, told a conservative political action conference event on Thursday. You have to take this message to your children and your nieces and nephews. What I love about young Mercedes Schlapp is she's like, we got to reach out to these young people. Grandparents, it's your job to do that.
Yeah. Every grandparent that's at CPAC, by the way, they're no longer invited to Thanksgiving. So good luck.
Schlapp was moderating a panel titled Free Stuff versus Free Dumb: Millennials' Love Affair with Bernie Sanders. So, like, this is their messaging going forward. This is how they're going to turn back the tide of, the leftward drift of an entire generation. But listen to this. The old story used to be, wait until they have a mortgage and they'll become conservative, said Timothy F. Mooney, an attendee who is a partner at the Republican political consulting firm Silver Bullet.
Ugh. Yeah, you know, that's...
They're literally saying that people we work for are undead, like anthropes. Yeah, no, he said, wait till they have a mortgage. But he said, honestly, I don't think that's true anymore. So I think...
Wait, what does that mean? Does that mean that he thinks all these millennials have mortgages and are simply unfazed, or that none of us have mortgages? Because that's a very unclear way of phrasing that.
I think it's a combination of that no millennials have a mortgage, and even the ones that do, it's not breaking right like it used to. Yeah. They just want to they get a house and they just want to protect what they have.
My name is Eric Wad from the Stake in the Heart Institute. I'm a 28-year-old millennial with a horseshoe pattern baldness, and my nose looks like a curly fry. I don't own a house, but I just like to take mortgages out because I like to pay the debt on them. Because I like obligation and responsibility.
It continues. On Thursday, 23-year-old Jonathan Stack was at sea. Again, great name.
Okay, that is just
every
a
single one
name.
Of these guys has a last name that's a sound you make when you drop something on your foot.
Schlapp and Stack.
Just plain Schlapps.
He's 23 years old. He's there at CPAC with a group of young conservatives called Turning Point USA. Dozens of Turning Point students milled around the convention hall wearing matching t-shirts with "Socialism Sucks" written on the front in Sanders' iconic font and style. When I go to campuses, people immediately see this and they walk right up. They see what we're talking about and we can have a good discussion, says Stack, a student at Penn State. I'm just going to edit that slightly and just say, when they see it, they immediately think, Christ, what an asshole. Yeah.
Nothing is cooler than a roving band of college students in matching parody t-shirts.
Yeah, that's, you know, the only thing that could fight them is a shirt that says, like, you know...
Socialism rules.
How about the guys, have you thought about this? It's Karl Marx and Lenin, and they're wearing party hats. And it says, Communist Party. It's like the both types of party. That's the only thing that could defeat that.
This quote from Stack is brilliant. He says, not every Sanders supporter will be willing to convert, but he says many are persuadable, and he's convinced more will become so during the Trump years. And I quote now from Stack, right now, it's just a Bernie Sanders fad. I really believe in what Trump and the Republicans can do with full control. When people see those changes in 2 or 3 years, they'll change on capitalism.
Look. I mean, I used to think, like, you know, I have no job opportunities. I need to work for free for 2 years for some reason before I can even get a job. And then, you know, I have this insurance that I can't afford care for. And just my life is a living hell. Every moment of my life is dominated by work. I make no money. But after Trump banned travel from Tunisia and then a court knocked it down and then he made a weird speech, I'm actually happy with my life now.
Once these millennials who are so sprung on socialism get a few of their relatives deported or assaulted and then lose their health care, they'll come around.
With the moment you see a 400-pound guy in body armor with a Blue Lives Matter tattoo stomp on your friend's head in the middle of the street, you're like, well, I'm, free enterprise is the way to freedom.
They go on to talk about how a lot of the young people who like Bernie Sanders and socialism don't really understand what it is. They just want free stuff. And I say personally, we should lean into that entirely. I want free stuff.
Yeah.
I think everyone should have free stuff.
Look at people's lives now. You already do pay. At the end of the day, what is the difference between your checkbook, between your fucking debt service that you have to pay? And taxes. At least you fucking get something out of your taxes if we go in this direction. That's what most kids believe now.
Yeah, that's the thing. Their parody is always, oh, these dumb kids think everything's for free. But no, everybody knows what taxes are. But right now, it literally just goes to creating these, you know, aircraft carriers and fucking airplanes that don't actually fly but cost $700 billion each. And they're like, well, what if I could go to the doctor instead?
Like, yeah, that's not insane. These people, these college sort of free market advocates are so confident that they're the only people, like Amanda Fapp is just so confident that they're the only people that understand like supply side economics. And And I think they take
it's economics 101, Amber. It's economics 101.
And I think they take that very seriously. And I think they arrived at this, startling conclusion for them. People who have never thought about this before in their lives, and they're like, my God, I have discovered the truth. I must go and spread the gospel. They're like insane evangelicals, except they're never going to even get married to have sex.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you, in the past 30 years, there's been sort of a takeover of academia and economics. A lot of that was a Koch speared effort to get a lot of Austrians in there. Austrians annexing, as they genetically like to do. And it was an incredibly well-funded effort to sort of propagandize what we think of as common sense economics, but it didn't really work for people at college, because at the end of the day, all you're getting out of that is the kid who comes to class with a walking stick and just mumbles it's supply and demand.
Well, those are the younger conservatives being quoted in this article. He goes on to talk to some of the older conservatives at CPAC, which were like 95% of the people attending CPAC. And their take on this was either even more blinkeredly naive or just even more just angry. So I want to read a couple quotes here. Someone said, in a panel discussion, this is Representative Ron DeSantis of Florida, said that if millennials saw that national monuments pay homage to America's heroes, they'd be more likely to adopt American values. Come to Washington. Go to the National Mall. See the memorials to Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, all these great people who stood for these great ideals. It's about articulating what it means to be America. That sense of history and understanding, I think it will make a big difference. Guys, we were just in D.C. a month ago. How did that go?
It definitely felt like Mecca. Yeah, totally. I'm getting the vibe.
Okay, one more. Listen to this. Overwhelmingly, most argued the biggest difference would come from changing American education. Ready for this name? Chris Astrieb. I'm just going to call him Chris Astrab.
Is that his like steampunk cosplay name?
Chris Astrieb.
Yeah,
I mean, you know how I am with names or whatever, but I'm just going to say
he has a monocle.
Chris Astrolabe. Chris Astrab, 64, of Fairfax, Virginia, said students had forgotten economics 101 because they failed to teach it in school. And then, you know, it goes on to talk about they need to learn about the dangers of the Soviet Union. This woman from the Heritage Foundation says, quote, they need to take a one-week trip to Cuba, spend some time there, and then come back and tell me about socialism.
Yes.
Anna Quintana of the Heritage Foundation, please send Alder DeChapa, the hottest young socialist outfit, to Havana for an all-expenses-paid trip for a week, and we'll come back and talk to you about socialism. One last quote here from the olds. This is not a funny name. It's Geraldine Davey, but this is funny. The only people Bernie appeals to are those in college with no direction, who are like welfare students and welfare people whose money is paid for by their parents, said Geraldine Davey, 76, of Virginia.
I bet she's I bet her grandkids love her. She sounds like just a delightful person. She says,
their parents pay for their money? Is that actually the...
This Geraldine actually is the most realistic. She says, there's nothing conservatives can do to change those mush for brains. They are just going to have to wait. When they have a job and a baby, they can talk to me about socialism, because then they'll say no thanks and become rugged individualists.
Yeah, the moment they have a baby and the Trump debtor protection squad doesn't let them take it home until they pay the hospital, they're going to be like, yeah, socialism's it's bad. Thanks, Geraldine, you old piece of shit. You bitter old fucking crone. Fuck you.
And I'm sorry, actually, that name is funny to me. Yeah. Maybe just because I smoked
Davey?
Weed. Yeah. It sounds like a name of an object of affection in a monkey's song. It's funny.
Yeah. It's a guy, someone with a bowl cut and a turtleneck fucked her in 1958.
During her beatnik phase. Yeah.
She was the subject of the famous 50s song, Oh Sweetie Baby by Gary Tasteman. Gary Tasteman, one of the inventors of rock and roll, tragically died when his blimp ran into Holland Tunnel, killing 300. I'm a rockabilly guy. I have a tattoo of all my favorite singers from the 50s. Gary Tasteman, Joey Popsicle, fucking Gary Buddy. My wife has bullshit rockabilly tattoos. We always get in fights, and I walk around the bar punching the doors, and I'm like, damn it! And my Marlboros keep falling out of the rolled-up sleeve in my shitty shirt and vest. It doesn't actually stay in, like in movies, but I get drunk and cry every anniversary of Gary Taisman's death.
So Felix moved to Greenpoint where there are still rockabillies, yeah. And he doesn't like them.
They're the worst pieces of shit in the world. I wish
that has been weighing on you.
I hate them so fucking much. They're such pieces of shit. They're the worst people in America. And I include
you sound like a man
members.
Who's never listened to Brian Setzer.
Yeah. Zoot Suit Riot. I'm racist and alternative.
Excuse me, that was the Cherry Pop and Daddies, who were Swing Revival, not rockabilly.
Felix, thank you for this digression.
Yeah, you're welcome.
But
yeah, I'm crying.
To put a bow on the socialism article, I think it's to say the Democrats have no fucking clue what's going on with young people in this country. But I feel like the Republicans kind of do. I think they have maybe kind of a better handle on it, and I think that's a good sign.
Yeah, you know why? Because they're not fucking losers.
Yeah. I mean, you know what's fucked up is every person under like 80 in this article's name is like Timothy Jacuzzi. And they're like, the moment I hold a girl's hand, I'm going to get them to stop being socialists. And they're somehow like smaller losers than the Democrats. That's fucking amazing. They're like bullying the Democrats. Fucking amazing.
It rules.
These are kids who like idolize Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
That's how much they're winning. But you're exactly right. They're winning a hell of a lot more than any fucking person under 30 who like still really loves Hillary Clinton.
Oh, absolutely.
That's for fucking damn sure.
They're like way bigger losers.
That's worse than being a rockabilly person, by the way.
This does, though, show that they don't really they win, yes, but they really do lean on that ethno-nationalism to actually get people to vote for them. Because you see in this article, their brainstorms on how to like talk these kids out of socialism are like, have you tried economics 101? And like nobody's gonna fucking fall for that shit. That's not actually persuasive. They have to have all that more emotionally powerful, like
yeah, they're the smug liberals of Republicans.
If they were just left to that, they would be the Libertarian Party.
Yeah,
yeah. This is the equivalent, like if a Juche candidate somehow stormed the DNC and won the presidency and was enacting Juche reforms and. There is still like a DNC staffed by the same people, and they're like, once the young conservatives realize about the earned income tax credit, it's like, no, you're on a totally different thing now. They're just doing something totally different.
And like I said, I it gave me cause to be optimistic, both because of how much energy and commitment is behind the left among young people, and how utterly hopeless both the Democrats and the Republicans are going to be attempting to, sell out these kids. I mean, they're going to sell them out, but I mean win them over, rather. Because, Ted Cruz is, I don't think, going to get it done for them. Moving along, the reading series for this week. I feel like it's been a while, but I think it's time for another classic Chapo reading series.
I'm so ready. Tell me a bedtime story. I'm baked out of my mind.
It's a double shot this week, and we're returning to two Chapo reading series mainstays. They're a great double pairing, like chocolate and peanut butter, because they're sort of different versions of the same person. But this week, we're going back to David French, email troop and warrior, wife protector, and bathroom security guard.
Bathroom warrior with perverts in the stall. Bathroom warrior. My wife goes to email and presses delete all.
And following after that, our friend Rod Dreher. So these are two quick hits from David French and Rod Dreher. The first one from David French was in the National Review today. A fan sent this along just this morning, and I saw it, and I knew we had to read it on the show. It's great. The title of the article is, "This is How Free Speech Slowly Dies." But the actual content of the article is completely irrelevant, because I'm just going to read the first half, where he does my favorite thing that David French does. Tell an anecdote from his life, being like, listen to this totally normal, cool thing that I did that completely betrays what an insufferable twat he is to everyone around him.
So I was letting my wife and son out of their kennels.
The subhead to this article is, the government is now subjectively policing the emotional impact of individual emails.
Not that I have a vested interest.
Again, so telling. It's he can't help himself. It's the emails again and their emotional impact on people's lives. It begins. Many years ago, when I was a brash young conservative lawyer working in a big law firm.
Do you mean rash?
And you were also never young. I guarantee you that this guy, bald at, 20, looked like a, he looked and talked like Spike Jones his entire life. I said something that could have ended my career and almost certainly would have today.
Was it the N-word?
It was definitely the
N-word. He totally said the N-word.
He was rapping along to one of his favorite songs, and he was like, no, they're saying it, not me.
He was doing the smooth cover.
He was just literally doing the entire Chris Rock routine.
They're like, David, we're putting you on probation in the firm because you didn't say Chris Rock voice before this.
It's even better, guys. It was March Madness, and I was running one of the firm's two bracket pools. As a basketball snob...
basketball snob. That area of fandom we all know and love.
The college basketball crank. Like I said, all these guys are the same fucking person. It's amazing.
By the way, basketball snob... As I take it to mean, it just means racist, because you're like, well, it was better before the African came in with his ability to dunk.
It was better when they only made bounce passes up and down a court. No, he said, as a basketball snob.
It was a way better game back when it took 18 minutes to get a layup. And
dunking was considered undignified.
Yeah, and all the cheerleaders like wore parkas.
As a basketball snob, I disliked the traditional pool because it was too dependent on sheer dumb luck. As I recall, a lawyer's 10-year-old kids had won two previous years, and I wanted a pool for serious fans only.
And I said, listen, you fucking kike. That's absolutely what happened.
This is
very advanced math students. Yeah. He just beat the shit out of him, so he got super mad. He's like, I'm not playing with you anymore.
Again, he's telling the story about when he was a brash young rebel, and in the first paragraph ends with him immediately being mad at someone's kids for winning the basketball pool because they didn't try hard enough.
If you're not a conservative by age 40, you have no brain. But if you're not a conservative by age 20, you've never been outsmarted by a child.
So it gets better. Listen to this. So I created what I called the conservative bracket.
We had like fun names for the teams, like the Kentucky Welfare Queens.
He says the conservative bracket is a pool that put a premium on picking upsets. In a firm-wide email, I said you could join the traditional liberal bracket where merit was irrelevant to outcome, and even the most ignorant fan could win a trophy.
Stop. Did he just say a firm-wide email?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's Freudian. The emails, they're coming at me. Jesus Christ, man. I said to someone.
I sent a simple throbbing email like I normally do.
8-inch uncut email.
There's no smegma on the email. It was perfect.
You're being too literal. That's too on the nose, Felix. We're having fun, but, He's at the liberal bracket, right? I like that he's upset. Like, the liberal bracket relies too much on just chance and luck. You know, like, how sports just generally do.
You know, it has nothing to do with chance upsets. You fucking moron.
It also has nothing to do with chance or luck, just being born into incredible wealth and privilege.
Yeah. My favorite thing about this is, all of David French's articles are usually like, liberals are, pussifying the Western male. And it's like, your defining moment of your youth was throwing a tantrum and starting a new fantasy basketball league because a child kept beating you.
I want him to keep rewriting this essay, though. Like, I want him to keep doing it and be like, and I never went to that pizza place again because that 13-year-old beat my Pac-Man score. I want him to start every essay he writes with a humiliating childhood anecdote for the rest of his life.
He wasn't even a child, though. He was a fucking adult man. Yeah, he was young, brash rebel. So, okay, so he sends a firm... wide email to everybody in this law firm, okay, decrying the quote liberal bracket and you know, sell, you know, giving the hard sell on his quote conservative bracket, you know, endearing himself to everyone who worked there, I'm sure, from the mailroom to the Tyus partner. We're like, this
yeah, like there was not a firm wide email immediately after that was just everyone saying, who is this asshole?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he says, that wasn't the offensive part. Just wait. He's proud of this. Once the tournament got rolling, I intended to start each Monday with a fun and highly politicized summary of the weekend's results. The year was 1995, and the mighty Arizona Wildcats were upset by Miami of Ohio in the first round, a result I predicted. So in the gleeful opening paragraph of my Monday morning firm wide email, this is now sent to every lawyer, paralegal, and secretary, I explained at some length that Arizona lost because it played like, quote, a bunch of girls. That's the offensive part.
Wow.
He says, okay, that was the offensive part. Like, everything he did before then wasn't
inappropriate.
I mean, not offensive, but just the most annoying thing that like a human being could do in a workplace environment. So he says, the chairman of the firm's management committee was a liberal feminist, and the firm's female partners were by and large quite feminist. What the fuck do you expect, dude? Like, you're working at a fucking law firm and, like, the senior partners are women. He's like, I don't know why they were offended by this email. Yeah.
It's also, like, entertain the possibility that they all fucking hated you and were looking for a reason to reprimand you.
Yeah, they were looking for something more justifiable than, like, please don't use the company email to start fucking... sports fucking pools.
David, please stop sending an all... partner's vascular email just simply titled Black Crime.
Oh, God.
Stop doing that.
He says, I heard through the grapevine that the partners were not pleased. I braced myself for the consequences. What I love about this as well is that he's annoyed by this, that he had to like face some kind of repercussions, but just in every other respect at the National Review, they believe that employees have no rights whatsoever.
Yeah.
And just should like be made to sit through like religious and like anti-union indoctrination like at will, basically. Or like that, you know, his contempt for like, let's say, fast food or service employees for not bowing and scraping to his every asinine request, I'm sure is virtually limitless. But he's annoyed about this because he pissed off literally his colleagues, not just like people who work for him.
Yeah.
His colleagues at this law
firm. Yeah, but they're female colleagues, so they're basically staff.
No, his female bosses, actually.
But they're staff to him.
Like,
yeah.
He's like, in my head, I imagined them being 80 feet tall and stomping on me with their feet. And my last breath was just their toe jam. In my just covering every orifice. Anyway, so the liberal workplace is
he was so pathological.
So he says, the next morning I came to work and saw that my office door was closed. When I opened the door, my office was empty and the walls were covered with posters of women's college basketball teams. I turned around and every woman in the firm was standing behind me, triumphant smirks on their faces. My secretary grabbed my hand and led me down the hall to the women's restroom where they'd put my desk and chair and taped David's office on the door.
That rules.
Oh, that's
guys,
so cool.
Guys, there's so many levels to this.
I think
the most
those are some down bitches.
Yes.
But this is the genesis.
I mean, they're probably evil cutthroat pieces of shit, but I love them.
This is the genesis to his bathroom paranoia.
This is like Spider-Man. This is like Spider-Man. He wanted to do a radioactive bathroom.
This is, oh, Jesus loves me.
I mean, who cares? Who cares?
Who gives a shit?
I don't give a shit.
It's about nothing. It's just him on the couch.
It's just he's on the couch. He's just typing.
No, this is like an email he sent to his therapist, basically. I'm just imagining him.
800 more words.
Yeah. I'm imagining him lying on a couch telling this story and a guy just like doodling, trying not to listen to the shit.
I like how like half
No, he's sitting on a couch and the guy behind him is fucking Dylan Baker from Happiness fantasizing about shooting up a park full of people. No, he like, I mean, who cares? But he just says, I wasn't called into human resources. You know, he said, they responded to my ham-handed attempt at humor with some humor of their own. I wasn't called to human resources. I wasn't counseled. I didn't have to attend diversity training. And I certainly wasn't fine. I kept rolling with my conservative bracket. And then in parentheses, he says, I came in last. And I kept sending firm, wide emails.
And then
I'm not even going to read the rest, but it just says, I thought of that incident while reading Eugene Volko's analysis of the ridiculous decision from the equal employment opportunity, blah, 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 blah. And then it goes on into some unreadable horse shit. But again, such a good anecdote, David French. Again,
there's so many levels to it.
And he used it all to segue to some just like totally esoteric,
boring.
You know, justification for why you should be able to fire someone if they have bad teeth.
Yeah, like this is the David French special, a very monstrous viewpoint, but it's backed up by a story that starts out incredibly mundane and goes into the territory of like, you know, I always hear my dad's voice yelling at me when I touch my dick in the urinal.
But it's like the first part of the Ralph Wiggum story that you only ever heard the second part of. Like, and that's why I'm happy I don't have worms anymore.
But he does
the first part and then ends on something terrible and boring from the Cato Institute or some bullshit.
That's David French. I hope Rod, our two-shot on this medley here, can live up to it, but... It's a quick one from Rod. I'm bringing this up because Rod's book is coming out called the Benedict Option book. For those of you not familiar with the Benedict Option, this is his new book length explication of this idea that since American culture and politics is just so hostile to Orthodox Christianity, they need to sort of withdraw from the world into these almost monastic like communities. And he's been on a tear with this lately because it got a big write up in the Atlantic that he didn't like because he thought, you know, the reviewer asked too many questions about what the fuck is up with you and gay people. And, you know, he says, I find it very odd that she focused on one chapter of the book and I find myself having to defend myself all the time. People keep asking me about, you know, gay this and gay that, but it's really not like the main thing I write about or my interests. And it's like, well, Rod, I don't know if Emma reads your blog at the American Conservative, but basically it's all you write about is gay people and trans people. And the answer she was trying to elicit from him was like, what does the Benedict Option, like, how are you trying to, like, live in, like, what are you offering gay people that you have to, like, live and work alongside with? Like, how do you feel about them? Like, where do you draw the line or whatever? And he was sort of evasive, and like all Rod's pieces, it just goes on and on and on, and he quotes at length. So I'm just going to sort of answer Rod with Rod, and I'm going to read from something else that that Rod has wrote that I think answers this question, or at least speaks to what he fails to realize about what people respond to in his own work. This is from January of this year, and this was in reaction to the commutation of Chelsea Manning's sentence.
Oh, boy.
Throughout this entire article, he refers to her as he, calls her a traitor, and there is one line here. He says that Dante consigned traitors to the lowest circle of the inferno, blah, blah, blah. He has this line. He refers to Chelsea Manning as the penis-having traitor suffers because people might not think she is, quote, a real woman. Think about that. Manning suffers serious psychological problems and has tried to commit suicide. I'm reading from him now. He should receive medical treatment, but not boobs grown at taxpayer expense on his traitorous breast and not liberty for breaking his oath under arms.
Yeah, I mean, we make fun of a lot about how Rod is a miserable fucking human being who never feels happiness. But he is a horribly nasty piece of shit who deserves every second of it.
Well, this is the problem, is that, like, in his reaction to Emma Green, he goes on and on and on about, like, how I don't, you know, I'm not obsessed to this. I'm a good person. Many of my best friends are liberals and gays. Some of my dearest friends are gays. And, like, you know, I've been getting along with them their entire life. And it's, yeah, like, fuck you. Like, who are these people?
He just sees, like, his friend open a can with his left hand and goes, oh, he's gay. I'm very open-minded.
But I mean,
one of my friends is even of Circassian descent. Rod, that isn't anything. What the fuck are you talking about?
Again, I only quoted that just to give you, like, just a little glimpse of, like, Rod being
he's
at his nastiest.
To, like, literal, like,
the real joy in this article and the reading series is going to come from the update. Now, keep in mind, in his response to, and he does this all the time, he goes, has these long-ass posts, and he keeps updating them. But again, he was mad at The Atlantic because he felt that they were too hard on his beliefs about gay people, or they focused too much on that, when he himself is such a magnanimous person who has so many gay friends, and he's not this monster. Okay, listen to this update. This is to his piece on Chelsea Manning. I was thinking just now about why this case made me so angry, and then it hit me. About 25 years ago, I shared an apartment with a gay friend, a college buddy, and helped him get settled and started. He ended up walking out on our lease and skipping town, owing me $800 and leaving me scrambling to find someone to take his room because I couldn't afford the apartment on my own. That was bad enough, but I had also loaned him my laptop so he could compose his resume and hunt for work. I found out later, after he had skipped town, that he had gone into my private emails, read them all, and distributed information he found good and gossipy, all at my expense. And while doing all that behind my back, he told his friends that it was okay because I was a conservative and therefore part of the oppressor class. Rod said, in again, his response to the Atlantic piece, that he has all these gay friends. He thought this guy was a friend, but I guarantee you, if this story is real at all, which I highly doubt, this guy hated his guts from the beginning and was just wanted, like, needed some place to live.
I would really like to know his side of the story, because maybe he did skip out on the rent, but it might have been after waking up one morning and turning around and seeing Rod standing nude in the doorway staring at him while he slept.
Rod was wearing an Eastern Orthodox cassock and chanting. I would skip out on the rent, too.
His gay friends agreed, apparently. The fact that I was a conservative justified his betrayal in his mind because conservatives oppressed gay people. Again, Rod, they do, and it does. Sorry.
Yeah. I hope he, like, put your towel in his ass. Like,
never mind that we had been friends for years. Again, I think he was just casual acquaintances, maybe. He stole information and money from me while I thought he was a good friend who deserved my help. No wonder the Chelsea Manning case infuriates me so. It felt personal in ways I had not anticipated at first.
Yeah, Chelsea Manning didn't leak your emails to Everlane or whatever the fuck. Yeah.
But what is his argument that, like, you know, queers are gossipy?
I gotta say that I shudder to think about what the Rod Dreher equivalent of the collateral murder video is.
Oh my god!
What was in those emails?
Man.
It's him. Yikes!
Update number two. Here we go.
Oh boy,
he says liberal people. Honestly, the update above has nothing to do with the justice or not of Obama's commutation of Manning's sentence. It only speaks to why the commutation may have made me a bit angrier than it otherwise might have. Yeah, angry enough to call Chelsea a penis-having traitor who deserves to die in solitary. You were a little bit peeved, Rod, maybe?
We say this all
He's mad about that $800.
Well, he says, the idea that pity for Manning's sexual and gender status was seen as exculpatory by many liberals, possibly even the president. The gay roommate I had stole private information from my computer and disseminated it among his friends for their entertainment and justified what he did because he was gay and I was a conservative, was part of the oppressor class, and whatever he did against me was justified in advance. My complaint here is not against Manning, but against liberals who have made him a hero, at least in part because he's a poor, put-upon transgender. If I had made him less culpable for his crimes, again, that's not Manning's fault. It was the fault of a certain kind of liberal.
Bravo! Bravo!
Oh, my God.
Rod Dreher, ladies and gentlemen, the Chapo Reading Series.
The one-man show.
Yo, put those motherfucking lighters up in the bathroom stalls. Oh, my God, what a piece of shit.
Jesus.
So, Rod, My message to you is nobody is fucking buying that you don't have a massive chip on your shoulder about gay people in this country. Stop fucking lying. You don't have friends. You don't have friends in general. You don't have liberal friends. You don't have gay friends. You probably don't even have conservative friends. Stay in your fucking monastery and keep writing made-up emails for the American conservative. You fucking twat.
Rod Dreher, you live in a fucking circus tent.
I gotta say that he does make a strong argument for the Benedict option.
He does.
Like, men like Rod should gather together and march into the wilderness and never be heard from again.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, stop posting. Stop getting off the fucking internet, okay? The internet is nothing but sodomy. Rod,
yeah, it's log gay off, here. Dude. It's real gay.
Log off.
Not our house.
I was on YouPorn looking at videos of women in PVC outfits getting inflated, you know, to talk about the book of Leviticus with other people.
By the way, if you are Rod's former roommate that robbed his money and email,
we'll send you
please contact us.
You can live with us.
Yeah. We need a roommate. That's it for this midweek show.
Yeah.
Yep.
Great to talk to you as always. Great to have you listen as always. Fans, friends. Goodbye.
See you in a bit.
Cheers.
Bye.